As part of the decade of commemoration, the Dublin-based publisher Four Courts Press took on the monumental task of producing an account of the War of Independence and the Civil War in every county in Ireland. So far, 18 of the 32 counties have been covered, the most recent being the county of Meath. The research and the writing of Meath and the Irish Revolution, 1912 to 1923, was entrusted to Kieran Wallace, Deputy Director of the Virtual Record Treasury of Ireland, which is in the process of recovering in digital form many of the records lost in the destruction of the Four Courts in 1922. And Kieran joins me now in studio. Welcome back to the History Show, Kieran.
Thanks very much, Miles.
Now, I'd imagine that Brian Hughes, in compiling the Dublin volume, which came out last year, would have been struggling with what to leave out. I wouldn't think you had quite the same problem with Meath, did you?
No, indeed. Meath is not Dublin or Cork, but that's not to say that it's not worthy of complete coverage, because I think what I found with approaching the Meath story was it's a social history. That's the approach I chose to take. And while there may not be like the 1916 Rising, or there may not be, you know, huge executions as there are in other parts of the country, everybody in Meath, everybody's ancestors in Meath experienced the Rising, they experienced the War of Independence, they experienced the Civil War, and people's ordinary lives lived through, wove between those major events. So once I got that mindset of taking a social history approach to it, I think it changed how I could have conceived of it. Wasn't looking for, there were dramatic events, goodness knows, but it is how people got to market, got the kids to school, how they looked for jobs, how they fell in love, and then how war and rebellion interjected into those day-to-day things. And I think the same model could be used for any part of the country, to be honest with you.
Yeah, because there were, as you say, significant events taking place in the county which would have impacted people, which would have changed their attitudes, which would possibly even have changed about the way they went about their daily lives.
Completely. I think the idea of either being terrorised or radicalised or just being affected, I mean, many, many cases. Of all the counties in Ireland, Meath had the second highest number of sort of physical destruction, second highest head count of physical destruction, as in road blockages, railway lines disturbed, roads being torn up, trees being felled. So just getting about your daily life was huge. But then again, if somebody is shot in the street next to you, that might terrorise you or radicalise you if you know that person, and it suddenly changes your political tenor, your political point of view.
Now, you devote some space to the stories, for example, of women who were attacked for fraternising with members of the Crown Forces. Was that common, and what sorts of punishment were meted out?
It was more common, I think, than was understood previously. I think during the decade of centenaries, a lot of great work was done by various researchers into attacks on women and sort of gender-based violence against women. In Meath, in Navan, an IRA group seized two women who were out walking with soldiers, keeping company with British soldiers. They took them to a field, they cut their hair, they forcibly sheared their hair. But they did this using scissors taken from the local barber shop, which was just around the corner from where one of the women lived. So the notion that they knew where to get the scissors was very intimate. So this was a thought out thing. When I read that first, I was kind of, this is a known story in Meath, and I saw the newspaper reports of it, and I was kind of shocked. The following day then, there was reports at the showgrounds in Navan of there being sort of an altercation between families connected with that attack the night before. And it's reported almost in a jocose way the next morning, the rows between the mothers. But it doesn't say whose mothers were involved. So this is like neighbour-on-neighbour violence, if you like. But it's women who are at the receiving end of the violence. And there are stories of women having their hair forcibly cut by IRA volunteers, but also by black and tans. There's instances I know of in Carlow, in Galway, in Longford. And of course, it's not just merely cutting someone's hair. They're being pinned down. There are groups of men coming in the night to take them from their houses. Many of the women are roughed up. They come back with bruised lips and bloodied heads and so forth. One woman even had her ears threatened to be shorn off. Now, whether they were going to do it or not, we don't know. But if you're a woman pinned to the ground by eight men with shears and they say they're going to cut your ears off, that's a pretty horrific thing to go through. So I think the research into that strand of violence, I think, and again, imagine what this does for those women later in lives and for their children, their daughters and their sisters. What that does about your attitude to violence, when the war's all finished, I think, that aspect.
The dominant figure on the IRA side in Meath was Sean Boylan, father and namesake of the man who managed the county to four All-Ireland championships. I just thought I'd throw that one in. Tell me about Sean Boylan.
Sean Boylan, I mean, he is a very interesting character in his own right. I think when you think of people, when he set out, like Sean Boylan was born in 1880. So by the time the 1916 Rising comes out, or even 1914, the start of the Volunteers, Boylan is in his 30s. He doesn't trust the volunteer movement when it starts. He thinks it's going to, well, even as it's being taken over by the Irish Parliamentary Party being annexed, he sets up kind of an independent volunteer unit. So he's from a sort of a Fenian and Republican type family. But again, does he can't see what he's heading into. He's going to become the dominant figure in County Meath.
He's IRB, isn't he?
He's IRB,
he's
yeah.
Close, I mean, at some point, he's close to Collins.
Oh, he becomes very close to Collins. That's after 1916. They meet, whether they knew before each other, knew before 1916, but they certainly became close in Frangoch. But he's, I think it's interesting, he's a single man right through the War of Independence. He doesn't marry until after the Civil War. Is that because there's just, it just literally, so I don't know how the man managed to keep up what he was doing, just being on the run and so forth. But he, by reputation, later in life, was sort of a very quiet man, very sort of kept his own counsel. Again, you wonder what decisions had he to make. He was not only commanding and leading large groups of men involved in very dangerous exploits, but he had to discipline guys who were not following orders. This is like all this being done on the run in an unstructured war. You know, what did that do for him as a person, I think, is a fascinating thought.
One of the most egregious actions by the Crown Forces in Meath, obviously, was the burning of the town of Trim. That was a reprisal. So tell me, first of all, about the IRA action that preceded it and prompted that reprisal.
Well, again, this brings in Sean Boylan into this. This was an amazingly complex and very successful, in the terms of the war that he was doing, successful raid that Boylan had planned for September 1920 on the RIC barracks in Trim. And this was a big former military barracks, a very big, substantial, like a mini fortress in Trim. He had large numbers of men come in with him on a Sunday morning. They blocked the approach roads. They waited till the main of the RIC body had gone to Mass, which again shows these are mainly local, rural Irish Catholic guys going to Mass. They seized the barracks with very little shooting going on. One constable is injured. They seized the barracks. They then surround the church, seize all the RIC coming out of Mass. They torch the barracks and then they make their way away. But what must have been hanging in their mind would be had been that only 4 or 5 days previously, the Blackened Hands had sacked Balbriggan, which is only a few miles away. So the notion of Blackened Hand reprisal was in people's minds, but this raid was set up. So Boylan had to go ahead with it. Within hours of the raid, the very successful raid on the Trim RIC barracks, suddenly lorries are arriving into Trim. The locals are terrified. The RIC and troops and auxiliaries arrive into Trim. They shoot some young fellows out playing football. And immediately the townsfolk come out, the local clergy come out. They say to the British commanders and to the Crown Forces, we will all stay in our houses. We'll make sure there's no further trouble. Just don't leave Trim alone. Don't come near us. Boylan had been planning to leave sort of a backup security detail in Trim to defend against a Blackened Hand reprisal. But he was convinced by the locals to say, look, you'll only antagonise the Crown Forces by staying. Please leave. We'll go into our houses. Everything will be fine. Which meant the town was actually left undefended. 3 o'clock in the morning, then comes this, as you say, egregious attack on the town of Trim. Such a terrifying thing. I mean, 200 men. Imagine how many lorries it takes, those big old noisy lorries in the 1920s that roll in at 3 o'clock in the morning.
And would they weren't all auxies or weren't all auxiliaries or were they all auxiliaries?
No, it was primarily auxiliaries that were coming in, Blackened Hands and auxies. So it was like non-regular troops, let's put it that way, non-regular forces. And they were shooting up, they burnt the market house. They did primarily attacked around Castle Street, Bridge Street, and Market Street, but they seemed to know the houses they were going for. So the sense is after the event, there was some local intelligence feeding into this, but they had people's houses being torched, houses being burnt, people being dragged out of their beds, you know, for a couple of hours that night, and the terror that must have been in that town that night, and the backlash that then created as people watched that sort of horrific event in the news or sort of read about it in the news thereafter. Dreadful destruction in Trim.
And as you say, very, very close to the sacking of Balbriggan. Meath had at least some impact, though, on the resignation of one of the leaders of the auxiliary forces, the World War I veteran Brigadier General Percy Crozier. What happened in the county that finally finished him with the auxies?
Well, as I say, he was in charge of the auxies. The auxies, on one of their other egregious, many, many egregious attacks, they attacked they raided the home of the pub and the home of the Chandler family at Robinstown outside Navan. And in raiding the house, they roughed up Robert Chandler. These would have been Protestant family, generally in the area seen as being a loyal family, like a unionist loyal family. They robbed goods from the pub, smashed up the pub, roughed up his elderly mother. And the reaction to that, even some of the police and the auxies who were on that raid saw it as being so sort of uncalled for, unnecessary and violent that even they reported back to Crozier and said, look, this is completely out of order. Crozier had a quick inquiry. He suspended about 32, 36 guys and then ended up actually dismissing over 20 auxiliaries as being sort of going acting completely beyond their orders. But those guys who were dismissed appealed above his head to General Tudor and were reinstated. And at that stage, Crozier thought, actually, these guys are off the leash. I can't control them, even as the commander level he was at. And at that stage, he walked away from it. He felt all the inquiries into that actually were a sham thereafter.
You mentioned the fact that the Oxys and the Tans were able to target specific houses in Trim. They had information. There were very few fatalities on either side in the War of Independence. I think it was three each, basically. Yeah. Not helped by the fact that whenever the Meath IRA laid an ambush, the RIC, the Tans and the Oxys had a habit of not showing up. What does that tell you about the levels of informing within the ranks of the Meath IRA?
It certainly was a big concern for them. And I think it was during the course, particularly in early 21, there was a series of abortive raids where the Crown forces failed to turn up. There was suspicion, they were hunting down or looking for informers and spies in the general community. But the notion of informers within the organisation itself was certainly something that concerned Sean Boylan. Mm. He believed
it's even, in his witness statement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he even named particular commanders who he felt were informing. But funnily enough, their men working directly with them said, absolutely not, no, we're happy to work with this guy. We don't believe he's an informer. They didn't believe Sean Boylan's fears. There is an attitude put again across that. It's not necessarily that it's that people want the auxiliaries to win or the British to win. It's a case of if you can stop an action happening, well, then you'll avoid a terrible reprisal on the particular area. So it's like it's one way of perhaps avoiding violence in your area, but obviously it's completely against the revolutionary spirit, what the IRA are trying to do. You have to sort of break heads to make a war, I suppose.
Now, the Meath IRA actually had a much higher hit rate on infiltrators and informers than on members of the security forces. Yeah. Tell me about some of the executions that were carried out.
They did indeed have a higher rate of executions. Again, often it turns out that these are ex-servicemen and sometimes believe, oh, this is a campaign against ex-servicemen. I don't believe it was. I think there were many, many, many ex-servicemen who never came to the attention of the IRA at all. But people like, for instance, the postman Bradley, who in early 21, he was accused of giving information to the castle. The IRA conducted a court-martial and executed him. So they had a bit of process to that. But there were other cases where in reprisal for a black and tan attack on a volunteer's house, like the case of John Donoghue. John Donoghue was taken out and shot by the IRA as an informer, sort of the next morning, dragged from his house overnight the next day without due process, if you call it court-martial due process. And again, people like Patrick Keelan, who was, again, warned, and he got fair warning not to be cavorting with the Black and Tans and be giving information. He fled the area, came back in, and was seen in a truck with Black and Tans. So
he was what they call an identifier.
Oh, completely identifier.
He was openly
doing that. But then there were cases like Dooner, a chap called Frank Dooner, who was in April 21, was badly beaten up and shot, left for dead, again, ex-servicemen. But actually, he survived amazingly, so he should win an execution in that sense. But it turned out, in fact, that there was a bit of bad blood over a piece of property and a workman's cottage, so there's motives.
Which prompts my next question. Was there always some justification, if you can call it that, for these executions, or were some of them quite dubious? Were some of them about land disputes, basically?
Oh, I think there were land disputes involved, and land was such a hot topic in Meath throughout the time in the preceding century. The case of Frank Dooner is one case where it's a small piece of land with a cottage that there's a dispute over that. But even cases like where people were falling out over, perhaps over personal relationships. There was, you know, one of the very few British army deaths was Sergeant John Herod, who was killed. People wondered, was he a spy? I don't think a British soldier in uniform was ever going to be a spy. But the notion was he was walking out with a local girl. His body was dragged from the Blackwater during the course of the War of Independence. So the motives could be personal, they could be communal, or they could certainly be genuinely political, yeah.
On the other side then of the extrajudicial coin was the murder in Navan of Thomas Hodgett, the local postmaster. How did he come to the attention of the Crown Forces, and what do we know about his death?
It seems that it came to the attention of the Crown Forces because he was a postmaster. He was giving information to Dublin Castle, ironically, about illegal activity amongst the Crown Forces. So it's a very complex time. And he's thinking these guys are acting way beyond the force of the law. And in the course of the night in February 21, he's, again, Church of Ireland postmaster in Navan. So the person you'd imagine would be completely outside the realm of what the Crown Forces would be sort of going after. But they drag him from his bed, mass raiders pull him from his house. He'd actually only recently had a stroke, so he's partially disabled from the stroke. They pulled him up by night, to much of his wife's terror and horror. One of those grim notions I can think of is that night the town is empty, but the next morning they find on the bridge near the Blackwater, they find blood on the road, but no sign of a body. He's been dragged right past the RIC station. So the RIC saw nothing, in inverted commas. But then a month later, Good Friday, his body is pulled from the Boyne, one shot found to his chest. So you see this notion of, you know, who did it? Who did it to him? The allegation is that the people who did it were IRA because they were speaking with Irish accents and speaking Irish. His wife, Grace, says, no, she knew Irish and she was from Irish herself. She said, this is definitely a put on accent. They'd taken him out as an act of terror or reprisal to shut him up for sort of squealing on the black and tans. Grace herself then had a terrible experience as the state basically shut her up and said she's a hysterical woman and they would not listen to her case. She was definitely speaking the truth, but they felt she was being manipulated.
Interestingly then, in June 1922, in the general election, which pitched the pro and anti-treaty Sinn Féin side against each other, the man who tops the poll in County Meath, not a member of Sinn Féin, he had two quotas, no running mate, but two quotas, Cathal O'Shannon of Labour. What does that tell you about the county?
Absolutely, it's really interesting. On the face of it, you could think the county had turned Republican Socialist overnight. I think it says something about boundaries, about constituency boundaries. It was a Louth-Meath constituency. So this is pooling the two counties, taking in the strong urban areas of Dundalk and Drogheda, which would have been O'Shannon's sort of power base, if you like. But O'Shannon, as a Labour man, was campaigning in a proper old-fashioned way during the election, because this was the packed election, so the pro and anti-treaty sides were kind of holding back from campaigning. But O'Shannon was out there not just campaigning, but campaigning about the type of things that people care about unemployment, about land reform, about education. So people were thinking, well, yeah, that's, we're looking to the future here. Maybe the public weren't that caught up on the niceties of the treaty, but here was a guy saying, I'll go to Parliament, or go to the Dáil, as it would be, and I'll fight for the practicalities of life. He got double the quota if only he'd had a second running mate, as you say. But I think it was a combination of his speaking about bread and butter issues and the fact that the combination of the two counties into one constituency gave him the run.
When it came then to the Civil War, would it be fair to say that most of the Meath IRA went with Sean Boylan to the pro-treaty side or remained neutral?
Yeah, I think most went with Sean Boylan. And when you look across the country, there's people try to spot patterns in which way IRA units went. That broadly aligned from the mouth of the Boyne to the mouth of the Shannon, southeast of that, it predominantly goes pro-treaty. But I think what's a more meaningful measure is local loyalties and local animosities. And the local loyalty to Sean Boylan was very strong. And Boylan was so close to Collins. So the loyalties flowed down from the leadership down to the members of the units that were there. But certainly it was predominantly pro-treaty IRA units, the way they moved there. And the anti-treaty forces were much less active, perhaps more active in the northern part of the county. And again, this notion that further from Dublin and in poorer areas tends to be anti-treaty, but also the northern part of the county is bordering with Cavan and Monaghan, which are much hotter in the Civil War. So there's a kind of a leak over. County boundaries are sort of fairly porous in that sense.
You make the point at the end of the book that when it comes to fatalities during the Anglo-Irish War, you say a simple head count is not a true reflection of what it was like to live through those times. Is that not simply a polite way of saying that the people of Meath had other things on their minds between 1919 and 1923?
Well, I think they certainly had other things on their mind. And I think everyone from the leadership of both sides, right down to the grassroots members and to the uninvolved, all had many more things on their mind, from sick children to jobs to keeping a roof over their heads and so forth. But I think the headcount is too blunt a measure. If you think of like terror, I think is a better measure of these sort of things. One shooting can cause terror throughout an entire community, but also the threats of shootings, the beatings up, a black and tan lorry driving by your house in the middle of the night is enough to terrorise anybody's neighbourhood. And I think those type of things, that invidious, sort of it's pervasive sense of terror and fear that must have hovered across the entire county throughout that period, I think that's the measure. And if you think on to 10 years later, 20 years later, those young people and adults who lived through that period, as they go on with their lives, they're carrying that with them. The notion of the fear of not being able to walk down the street at night, of being curfewed into your houses in Trim, of seeing burnt out buildings that aren't going to be repaired for many years. I think that's maybe a greater measure of the actual impact of the war on County Meath than the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 headcounts, which is tragic for those, but it's a much wider fear that pervades the county.
The book is Meath and the Irish Revolution, 1912 to 23. It's published by Four Courts Press. The author is my guest, Kieran Wallace. Kieran, many thanks for joining us on The History Show.
Thanks, Miles.